I'm Tom Martin, and this is Eastern Standard, a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced with the support of One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, and Dynamics Productions. In this hour, smarts, tobacco, hemp oil, trains, humans, and art. So starting at the top of that list, Trima Gentry joins us. Trima is Executive Director of Partners for Education at Berea College. And in this role, she advocates for rural students living in poverty and makes sure that any national dialogue about educational success includes the voices of rural students. She knows quite a lot about this, holding a bachelor's degree in political science from Berea College and a law degree from UK. Trima herself is a first-generation college graduate from rural Appalachia. Thanks for joining us, Trima.
Thanks for having me.
So first, if you would tell us about Partners for Education. What sorts of direct services do you offer?
So Partners for Education is a part of Berea College. And we were formed, we've been doing this work for about 20 years. And it really is focused on giving students interventions to get them ready for college. So on the ground, we're doing work in 31 counties. We've got tutors in schools working on math and English language arts. We have mentors. We have AmeriCorps members that are helping kids do college planning and prepare for the ACT. Really, the services of Partners for Education are varied, and they're really what we give our children when we're trying to get them ready for college.
I know that an ultimate goal of yours is to develop a national model for rural education through the work that you're doing. What does that look like? How would it differ from what's in place now?
Well, I think on the national level, when we talk about education success, we often forget about rural communities, rural places, and rural students. So our desire is to ensure that when policymakers at state levels, federal levels, are thinking about education and success, they're thinking about rural places and rural kids, which means that when they write policy and they create legislation, they have to realize that in rural places, you have geographic isolation, you have lack of broadband, lack of internet, and that any services and policies need to take that into consideration.
When you talk about systems change strategies, what sorts of systems do you mean?
So I think when we think about systems, we think of it on multiple levels. I think at the local level, you have your school and how schools do their work. And in Eastern Kentucky, we have principals and teachers that are working to ensure that all kids are successful. Unfortunately, they don't have the funding and they don't have the resources and the support to serve all kids the way they need to be served. So when we think about systems change, we're thinking about how do we help schools be more efficient, use data to ensure that each kid is getting the interventions right for them. We also need to think about systems change around funding of education and ensuring that education across the state is equitably funded. Those are just two examples.
Okay, speaking of funding, can you ballpark for us funding that over the years Berea has channeled into southeastern Kentucky counties? And what happens in those communities when there's no more money in the pipeline? Are they sustained in some way?
Yeah, so my work has been through federal grants from the Department of Education, where we work in partnership with a school or a community to write a grant application. We submit it, and we've received the funding. So I've been doing this since 1995 as part of Berea College. And I would say that we have close to $500 million in educational programming going into the region since 1995. Currently, our budget and the work that we're doing through our Promised Neighborhoods and our Gear Up work is over $40 million this year in federal dollars. And I often get that question, you know, once the grant goes away, will the program be sustained? And I can tell you it won't be sustained at the level. With Promised Neighborhood, we're able to put 30 educators in a school district to assist the school in doing that important work. That can't be sustained after the federal grant. However, the kids in that school over that 5 years of that program are getting needed services.
And that's just the nature of a grant.
And that's the nature, I think, of a region like our Appalachian region, where there is no local investment because there's just not the local resources, and private philanthropy has forgotten about our region. We're not seeing the investment that other places in the nation see. So we're having to build and do these essential services using federal dollars.
You mentioned Promise Neighborhood. Tell us about that.
So Promise Neighborhood, we're in year 10 of Promise Neighborhood. And actually, it was modeled after a program in Harlem, New York, where Jeff Canada took this idea that if you work in one place and you provide the kids in that neighborhood, that block, with after-school programming and high-quality tutoring and opportunities to explore and think about careers, you could actually change the future for the whole community. We were the first community to do Promise Neighborhood in a rural place. Our first Promise Neighborhood was Owsley, Clay, and Jackson County here in Kentucky. You can't imagine a place more different than Harlem. But what we found is our program is working with the schools, developing strong plans to ensure that every child has opportunities to all those services, and it does impact the outcomes.
Can you give me an example of how that has impacted the outcome?
Yeah. So one of our big pieces is academic proficiency. We want all kids to graduate high school ready for college academically. So in the first 4 years of our Promise Neighborhood, from 2012 to 2016, when we started, 27% of the young people were proficient in math. By 2016, it was at 40%. That's a significant increase of all students being proficient in math. K readiness, we know kids have to enter kindergarten ready to learn or they're already behind. When we started the work, 16% of the kids were entering kindergarten ready to learn. In 4 years, we got that up to 36%. So it is significant growth, but even where we are now, there's still significant improvement that needs to happen.
What do you say to those who think that our region has been subjected to too much talk, too many promises, too little follow-up action?
I think they're right. I think that it's often we spend too much time thinking about how what the data says or thinking about what would be the solution that could change things. What we've decided with the work at Partners for Education is we have to do something. And so we work with schools, we work with communities to design these programs, and we do them. We get funded and we do the action. We know that we haven't found the right model yet to serve all kids, but we're still looking. And I think a piece of it is we get paralyzed as a community into inaction because it is such a huge, often seems insurmountable to think about how do we revitalize this region, but we have to at least do something and continue to do something.
One issue that we have among many is that Central Appalachia has been experiencing a pretty steady exodus of our young. Some say this is due to, in large part, to a lack of economic and educational opportunities. What do you say about that?
I mean, we see the data. We see young people. And I guess I need to preface it that our work at Partners for Education is really to ensure that every young person has an opportunity to attain a college degree. We really believe, and data shows us, that college is the surest pathway to success. And when I'm thinking about success, I'm thinking about economic mobility, health indicators, you know, the ability to just enjoy life and not have to worry about paying the bills, that college is the surest path to that. But we also know that as young people attain college degrees, the jobs are not in the region for them to come back to. So we've really put our flag in the ground and said we're here to ensure that every student has the opportunity to succeed. And we know that many of those young people to succeed will have to leave the region. We hope, and a lot of our work with middle school and high school students is to help young people understand the place and to really love and understand their roots. So we do hope that maybe they do leave, but they come back later, right? Mm-hmm. But we can't expect young people to stay here when there's not that opportunity for that quality of life.
Your organization is Partners for Education, and I know you count among your partnerships the Pritchard Committee for Academic Excellence. What's going on there?
So we have just worked and developed a new project with the Pritchard Committee that really focuses on parents and how that parents are essential for students to find their own success and their route to success. And we've gotten some funding to open a center. It's actually not a physical center. It's more of a project in 31 counties here in Appalachian, Kentucky, where we can provide parents with the resources and the support and the encouragement to help their kids plan for success.
And what are some other key partnerships?
Well, I think our key partner are the schools. When we think about the communities that we work in, the school is the center and has been the center of the young person's experience. And so how do we help the schools? And how do we help schools become, again, that place where after school and summer programming takes place, right? So the schools are a key partner. We also look at the faith-based community. It takes a village. I mean, as trite as that sounds, it takes a village to actually support young people. How can our churches, our faith-based community do more? I think they want to do more. Sometimes they need that guidance. And so we see churches that are doing feeding programs for kids during the summer and during the winter time when school's out of session. Got some schools now that are actually doing Head Start and preschool in the church. So the faith-based community is another key partner. Then we also have some national partners that also are committed to the region. Save the Children is one of those. Save the Children started in Appalachian, Kentucky, and they do home visiting and 0 to 5 work, where they go into families and work with parents and kids. And they've been a key partner in the Promised Neighborhood work.
Should or can more be done through education to make youth of color and LGBTQ youth living in the region feel welcome and feel safe in their communities?
I think definitely. I think through education, and I think it's an imperative that we do. I think we often get distracted by the fact that we are predominantly white region, and we forget that if you're a young person of color living in this region, it's an even tougher place to live. And I think the same thing goes is true for LGBTQ students. It's important that schools be safe places, that communities be safe places. I think it's also incredibly important that we listen to young people, because I can't tell you as a 50-year-old woman what it would take to make a school a safe place for a young person. But those young people who have just come through the system, they understand and they know that. We need to bring them to the table and let them shape our community.
We have these competing forces in Eastern Kentucky on a macro level, on a micro level. One is this collection of serious issues that we have: drug addiction, child homelessness, a litany of health problems. And the other is energized by this driving desire to give the world a better story about the region. So how do we acknowledge the real problems in the region while building a better narrative about Appalachia?
I think we have to own our data. And our data does show that this is, you know, like you said, one of the most difficult places to live when you think about those outcomes and those indicators. And that's systems level data that we have to work to change. But I think we also, it's the bright spots, or what we call them. There are things happening throughout Appalachia. There are leaders, young leaders, that are really doing great work. And we see pockets of places where they have shifted those data points. And to me, it's understanding that on the large level, the data still is what it is, but that the work is happening at the local level. And how do we also look at the bright spots and start replicating and scaling those up?
So, Dreema, how would you say that your work in education leads to a better future for students in Appalachia? And how does that work impact the communities they live in?
So I think that, and it goes back to this personal piece. I mean, as you mentioned, I'm the first in my family to go to college, and so I grew up here. And education was what broke that cycle of undereducation and poverty for me. And it gave me the opportunity to really imagine a career where I could have impact on community. And I think that's what education does. I think that real education gives young people an opportunity to have dreams, to figure out what is the pressing problems they want to be part of the solution for. And if we can do more of that, empowering young people to take that ownership and to give back, it will eventually come back and help the community.
Okay, we have just a little bit over a minute left, and I know that you and your team have been working hard getting ready for this year's Rural College Access and Success Summit that's happening in Lexington. Can you give us some highlights of the agenda?
Yeah, so one of the things we realized 2 years ago is that there were a lot of people working on college success for rural students across this nation, in the Delta, in the Native American lands, along the border. But we never came together as a rural community and thought about what are we doing? What are the best practices? We also never have really put our voice together and said we need policy and legislation to ensure that rural students are successful. So that's the purpose of the summit. It's for practitioners and people who believe and want college access for all students that are in rural places. So this year we have John King. He was the Secretary of Education under the Obama administration, coming in talking about equity and what does equity look like in rural places. And I think that gets at your previous question around safe places for young people. We also have Nancy Hale, and Nancy leads Operation Unite here in Kentucky, and her work around the opioid epidemic and how can we as educators and college access professionals, how can we make sure that the kids who are growing up in the midst of that opioid crisis, that they're successful. So those are the two of the pieces I'm most looking forward to.
And is information registration available online?
It is. It's at the www.berea.edu.
Dreema Gentry, Executive Director of Partners for Education at Berea College, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming up after the break, a new law taking effect in 2020 would ban all tobacco products on all school campuses in Kentucky. But Ben Chandler of the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky says the new law may sound stronger than it really is.
There was an opt-out clause, which allows these school districts to opt out if they want to have a policy that allows tobacco.
Plus, a report on the pros and cons of hemp oil. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Attendees are future thinkers who view technology as transformative opportunity for their business and lives. They share a belief in the boundless power of one idea to change everything. The 35th Annual Conference, 119, is May 19th through the 21st, 2019, in Lexington. Learn more at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
Ben Chandler is Executive Director of the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky, and he also chairs the Coalition for a Smoke-Free Tomorrow. And that's what brings him back to Eastern Standard. Our focus today, e-cigarettes and vaping. Thanks for joining us, Ben.
Good to be with you, Tom.
So under a new law that was just passed by the state legislature and signed by the governor, all schools in Kentucky will soon be tobacco-free. Tell us about this new
law. We've been trying to get this passed for a long time and run into obstacles, but this year we had the support of the Kentucky school boards and the superintendents across the state, which we had not had before. So we were able to get the law passed, and the law essentially says that you cannot have any tobacco products on school campuses 24/7. That's all K through 12 campuses throughout the state, and it also includes athletic events and other extracurricular events.
And where did most of the pushback come from?
Well, the pushback came from some of the retailers who sell tobacco products and who always oppose these kinds of laws. And it comes from some of the schools who don't want to try to enforce it, usually particularly in Western Kentucky and rural Kentucky.
Well, this new law doesn't really take effect until July 1st of 2020, so that's a good year away. Any thoughts about what to do in the meantime?
Well, unfortunately, there was an opt-out clause, which allows these school districts to opt out if they want to have a policy that allows tobacco. We're going to try to go around the state as a foundation in conjunction with School Board Association and try to prevent schools from opting out during that period. They also need to get their signs in place, and that's why it's given an extra year for it to take effect. They need to get their signs in place and their enforcement procedures in place.
And are there districts out there that are considering or planning on opting out?
Well, there are some, I think, that will want to do that because some of the districts didn't want to see this happen in the first place. In fact, 58% of the districts in Kentucky did not have tobacco-free school campuses, which is why this was necessary. So 58% of them obviously didn't want to do it on their own, which means that at least some of those will probably try to opt out, and we want to keep that from happening. But we think the lion's share of them will go ahead and go along with state law.
Well, Rite Aid recently announced that they're stopping sales of e-cigarettes, vaping products, out of the concern that they're fueling tobacco use among middle and high school students all across the country. What does the data tell us about increasing use of tobacco products, including these products, among high schoolers?
It tells us that we have an epidemic on our hands. In fact, vaping just in the last year increased amongst high schoolers by 78% in 1 year and amongst middle schoolers by 48%. So we've got a tremendous problem amongst young people. These products, these vaping products, are very attractive to young people. They are made sleek. Stickers are created that they can put on them to make them attractive. They are offered in many different flavors like cotton candy and bubble gum. You can't tell me that you're not aiming at a younger population when you produce flavors like cotton candy and bubble gum. Yeah, and that's the problem. These vaping products actually have some efficacy in terms of helping older people get off of cigarettes, but they are not at all designed or shouldn't be designed for young people because they can be a gateway and they addict people. They're full of nicotine. One pod of these e-cigarette products has as much nicotine as 1.5 packs of cigarettes.
So that pod is really toxic.
Very toxic. And nicotine does damage to a developing brain.
There's new research out that probably just confirms what we've known, conventional wisdom, and that's that the odds of smoking for American adolescents are 50% higher in rural areas than in urban areas, and it's occurring even as rates of teen smoking in both settings have fallen. What's going on here?
Well, teen smoking in both settings had fallen until this new epidemic of vaping.
Sure.
And now the rates are beginning to rise again. It's basically erased all the gains that we've made over the years in smoking amongst young people. And that's one of the things that concerns us. We're addicting an entirely new generation. And, of course, it is worse in rural areas. Almost all health metrics are worse in rural areas. And that may be have something to do with education levels. It's hard to say, but the statistics clearly show that rural areas have greater challenges when it comes to smoking rates and other health indicators than urban areas.
Now, what we've been talking about so far involves national numbers, but I think I understand that you're anticipating Kentucky-specific information, especially about e-cig use and vaping, from the Centers for Disease Control.
Yes. The e-cig problem is really a new problem. It's a burgeoning epidemic that just came upon us within the last year or two. So we don't have real good data yet that's Kentucky-specific. We do hope to have that. But what we have done is we have put together focus groups in five different counties across the state, some urban, some rural, with kids themselves. And they show some interesting things. Number one, it shows that the kids don't realize that these things are bad for them. They think that they're fine and not dangerous. That's one finding. The other finding is that the adults don't know what's happening. It's going on right under their noses, and the kids realize it. They can use these vaping products in class and not even be detected. So it's a tremendous problem, and the kids themselves say that their cohorts, their friends, are using these all the time.
The manufacturers know what they're doing, though, don't they? I mean, the flavors that are provided with a Juul, let's say,
well, sure,
would seem to appeal to a young palate more than an adult.
Well, again, bubble gum, and cotton candy. You cannot tell me that those are aimed at adults. I'm not going to believe you if you tell me. I just think it's clear that the manufacturers are targeting youth users, and they're addicting an entirely new generation of young people in this country. And it's going to lead ultimately to more cancer, more heart disease, and poorer health amongst the population generally.
I know that this has kind of come on very recently, but is there any research or any evidence so far about health effects that are specific to e-cigarettes?
The main thing that's specific to e-cigarettes is the amount of nicotine that's in them. And nicotine is one of the most addictive substances on this earth. There are many researchers who say it's more addictive even than opium. So, you know, it's tremendously addictive. And there are also some ideas that we really don't know what's in the e-cigarettes. The FDA has not approved them and has not looked into the things that are in them. But we know that they have heavy metals. They have toxic aerosols. We don't know in what degree, and we don't know how harmful they are yet. But I can tell you that it's not a good idea, as a general matter, to introduce anything into your lungs that isn't oxygen.
I mentioned earlier Rite Aid's decision, and it's clearing its shelves of these products. But the Food and Drug Administration has also fired off letters to a dozen other retailers. They include Walmart, Family Dollar, asking them to submit plans within 30 days describing how they plan to address and mitigate sales of tobacco products in general to minors. But still, nobody so far has gone as far as CVS. They stopped selling tobacco altogether in 2014. They took a $2 billion hit to their bottom line doing that. Do you think others will or should follow suit?
Well, of course I think they ought to follow suit. You know, you may have companies who make some money on the front end by selling tobacco products, but all of the data shows us that the cost to our economy and to society generally is so much greater on the back end in terms of health costs that it's not good economic sense to continue to sell products that make us sick and kill us. Companies will tell you, the Kentucky Chamber of Commerce will tell you very quickly that companies won't come to Kentucky because we don't have a healthy workforce. Why don't we have a healthy workforce? Well, we have this huge percentage of people in Kentucky who smoke, and that causes costs for the company on the front end in terms of lower productivity and costs on the back end in terms of higher healthcare costs. It's a big problem.
In another interview that's going to air later on Eastern Standard, we hear a statistic that the Eastern Kentucky region has one of the highest, if not the highest, cancer rates in the United States.
Well, it has the highest. In fact, Kentucky as a whole leads the nation in cancer. We're the cancer capital of the country. Now, I don't know how most people feel, but I think that's intolerable. I think we ought to do something about it and do something about it yesterday. And it's just Eastern Kentucky is the center. I saw a study about a year and a half ago, and it's what really got me on this kick, that showed that cancer mortality in this country had actually declined by 40% in the last 30 years. In Eastern Kentucky, though, it had increased. And it was unbelievable. Eastern Kentucky was specifically pointed out in this report as just about the only place in the country where it had dramatically increased while cancer mortality was declining everywhere else.
Oh, boy. Well, given the new law that's going to take effect a year from now and the efforts that are being made that you all are making, is there anything else that you feel needs to be done about e-cigarettes in particular among young people in Kentucky?
Well, one of the things that comes immediately to mind is that we need to raise the age of purchase from 18 to 21. There's lots of research available showing that that will ultimately reduce the use of tobacco products, including e-cigarettes. And kids who are underage, high school kids, middle schoolers, they generally get the products from their buddies, and they hang around kids who are 18 and who can buy them legally. They very seldom hang around kids who are 21 and older. So if you raise the age to 21, you're going to see a decline in the rate. I think that'll have a big impact, and we're going to push that effort.
Ben Chandler is Executive Director of the Foundation for a Healthy Kentucky. He also chairs the Coalition for a Smoke-Free Tomorrow. Thank you, Ben.
Thank you, Tom.
Senator Mitch McConnell proposes establishing 21 as the minimum age nationwide to buy any tobacco product, including e-cigarettes. The Courier-Journal reports that McConnell's proposal has the support of the tobacco industry. Hemp products are becoming hot sellers, especially CBD oils, creams, balms, and tinctures. Users say CBD has a wide array of health benefits. But as we hear from Liam Niemeyer with the Ohio Valley Resource, there so far is little evidence to support the health claims. And researchers worry that CBD sales are far ahead of the science.
Hi. Welcome.
Thank you.
Inside the Bluegrass Hemp Oil Store in Lexington, Kentucky, the CBD oils and lotions lining the walls have a story. A story of a family struggle.
We took a huge risk, to be perfectly honest, because we didn't know.
That's co-owner Adrian Polinick. She says her son Colton began having violent seizures when he was 3. The family tried a litany of prescription drugs, which controlled the seizures but caused harmful side effects like hair loss. They then tried CBD oil. Polinick says Colton's seizures dropped to 0. Now she wants to help others discover the benefits she thinks CBD holds.
A lot of people are seeing relief with CBD products, and I think it goes a long way to prove the efficacy of what's going on and what people are saying.
And people across the country say CBD is helping them with issues including sleep, mental illness, arthritis, and skin conditions. But there's little to no scientific evidence to support these claims. Clinical researchers in the Ohio Valley say there's still not a lot known about the substance.
I think that there's a lot of concern amongst physicians, medical providers, and research scientists like myself that we are moving too fast without proper evidence and information.
That's Dr. Anoop Patel of Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio. He helped contribute to a 2018 study that showed a CBD-based drug cut patient seizures due to epilepsy on average by 40%. The study led the Food and Drug Administration to approve the first, and so far only, CBD-based drug. Beyond epilepsy, CBD research is still very new. Researchers are conducting trials to determine CBD's effects on treating cancer, bipolar disorder, and more. West Virginia University dermatologist Zachary Zinn helped conduct one of those new studies. He looked at CBD's effect on a rare skin condition that causes severe blistering.
It wasn't, I'm having a little less pain. It was, I no longer require morphine for my dressing changes.
Zinn thinks CBD is relatively safe to ingest in small doses, but he isn't recommending it to patients because there's little clinical research.
I think to think that it's going to be a wonder drug for all the things that patients are reporting benefit in, it's just probably not going to happen.
But that hasn't stopped the area's hemp industry from pushing forward. Roger Hayes of Green Remedy, a CBD business in Louisville, says clinical studies are not a priority.
America doesn't need to wait that long to know that something that has been around for thousands of years, that people have taken it for various reasons. We shouldn't have to wait that long.
Many in the industry want the federal government to hurry up with regulation. The FDA said in December that CBD in food products is still illegal. Ohio stores selling CBD food have been raided. Kentucky Agriculture Commissioner Ryan Quarles is one official advocating for CBD food approval because of the boost it could give to hemp farmers.
We don't want to regulate hemp to death in America now that it's finally legal.
But some in the industry are more hesitant. Matthew Smith is a massage therapist in West Virginia who uses CBD oil to ease muscle pain in his clients.
Anecdotally, there are plenty of people it's helped. It is possible that we'll find that it's overblown. There's still a lot of science to be done.
The first FDA public hearing on CBD-infused food is scheduled for late May. For the Ohio Valley Resource, I'm Liam Niemeyer.
The Ohio Valley Resource is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and WEKU. Still ahead. Chesapeake and Ohio Steam Locomotive 2716 will lumber through the bluegrass this summer. We'll tell you about its new home in Appalachian, Kentucky. The latest in our series, Humans of Central Appalachia, takes us to the mountains near Cumberland, Kentucky.
It's home. They're beautiful. This is where I was born and raised.
We visit with Brittany Boggs. And don't worry, neighbors, Brittany has good things to say about you.
They're the sweetest, kindest people you'll ever meet.
And the Lexington Art League's Adrian Dixon is here with details of a new spring arts festival. I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.
Eastern Standard is made possible by One, the All-Tech Ideas Conference. One is an incubator of innovation, a forum for future thinkers, and a platform for propelling forward the promise of a planet of plenty. Attendees view technology as a transformative opportunity for their businesses and lives in order to make a difference in the world. Learn more about 119 in Lexington, May 19th through 21st, 2019, at one.alltech.com.
Major support for Eastern Standard on WEKU is provided by the law firm Hicks & Funson. Kentucky lawyers Josh Hicks, Greg Funson, and Shannon Church provide legal advice and representation in the areas of personal injury, catastrophic accident, and immigration law. Learn more at hfkylawyers.com. Eastern Standard continues with Tom Martin.
We're keeping an eye on efforts to reinvent the economy of Eastern Kentucky. Tourism is on a lot of minds. And one such effort is happening in the Estill County town of Ravenna. Back in March, Chris Campbell, president of Kentucky Steam Heritage, told us about plans to establish a Kentucky Rail Heritage Center in Ravenna, a town that was established in the early 1900s by the L&N Railroad. And the next step in that plan is about to cause double takes. Restored and ready to roll, 2716, a massive 75-year-old 400-ton Chesapeake and Ohio steam locomotive, will rumble through the bluegrass this summer.
2716 will be moving on July 26th through 28th from New Haven, Kentucky to here in Ravenna.
That's Chris Campbell from a video that you'll find on our website, esweku.com.
And we want to make sure that everybody is aware of it and has a good time chasing it and is safe. We need to make sure that the people that come see it and photograph it have a great experience, but at the same time respect the fact that it's moving on live rails. And the only way that we can continue to do things like this with CSX, with RJ Corman, and just throughout the nation in general with Class 1s is to be safe and respectful of railroad property.
The project is supported by RJ Corman Railroad Group and CSX.
We're bringing about some change in an area that badly needs it.
That's Eric Hendrickson, Director of Network Planning, CSX Transportation.
The Kentucky Steam Heritage Center will be a center point of Ravenna, Kentucky. It's in an area that we've recognized that needs a hand up. CSX is proud to stand by and give that hand up. And we're really looking forward to seeing the area turn around and become very vibrant again. It's already showing signs of it, just what little we've done already, and it's terrific. The thing that sets the Kentucky Steam Group apart is the fact that they have a plan. They're just not a bunch of dreamers. They actually have a written down goal, and that they're realistic in their goals. They're not trying to do a wide expanse and save everything under the sun. They've got a very intimate goal of it that they've had. They've stated it to us, and it's a very realistic goal. So CSX is proud to help the Kentucky Steam Heritage Corp, and we look forward to working with them in the future for some potential fun stuff. And we look forward to revitalizing Eastern Kentucky, which is the main goal.
Last May, Kentucky Steam struck a deal with CSX to purchase a 40-acre tract of decommissioned rail yard in Ravenna. The plan is to convert this into the Kentucky Rail Heritage Center that will feature a railroad restoration shop and include a partnership with Estill and Lee County Schools. And the plans also call for a restaurant, brewery, an event center, concert venue, and walking trails. The latest in our monthly series, Humans of Central Appalachia, takes Malcolm Wilson's microphone to Cumberland, Kentucky, for a visit with Brittany Boggs.
I'm your typical coal miner's daughter, and I got a twin brother, so I was one of the boys. I was never bored. He's my best friend. To this day, he's my best friend.
Brittany is a single mom of three with a day job that she loves.
I'm a registered nurse. I've worked at the Harlan Hospital for 7.5 years.
So what was it like growing up in the mountains of Eastern Kentucky?
Oh, man. There's nothing like it. We might have crammed a bowl of Fruity Pebbles down our throats, and then out the door we went. Yeah. We were in the mountains, the creeks, from daylight till dark. That was life.
Good memories of high school.
Bonfires and trail riding, football games. I was a softball player. I just wasn't your cheerleading type. I liked softball. That was my thing.
And home was great.
I have the most wonderful parents ever. If it wasn't for them, I couldn't make it.
From high school on to Southeast Kentucky Community and Technical College to pursue that career in nursing.
Because I love to take care of people. I just always have. There's nothing like it.
But ask Brittany what she loves most, more than anything in the world. It's those three kids.
I was washing dishes. Caden comes through the house screaming, "She got it, she got it, she got her first one." And I'm like, I didn't hear a gunshot. Oh my God, what did she get? You know, him and Angel was out here playing. I said, "What do you mean she got her first one, son?" Well, I cut the corner and a tree was laying through the house.
A tree?
She cut her first tree down when she was about 6 years old.
She brought it to the house.
And they brought it to the house.
And
drug it in the front door. And it laid across the living room so that to make Mama proud, I guess.
And then there are the critters.
We got all kinds of critters. We got a turkey right now. Her name's Missy. We got two ducks, Quacky and Splashy. We got a couple of hens. Our hens don't have names. They're just hens. We got a rabbit named Bigfoot.
And the bear that pays visits and why she keeps a bear kit handy.
My bear kit, yes, it's actually in the door of my car. My bear kit consists of some firecrackers and some matches. I have a bear kit because I have a bear, which we've named Yogi. And Yogi comes down, he's eased up now since we got the dog. Yeah. He used to come every morning, he'd sit right there and look at us. So yeah, bears, they're pretty, but they kind of scare me.
As a coal miner's daughter, mine closings trouble Brittany, and drugs.
I think a big part of it is, you know, there's nothing for young people or children to do. Once they get out of high school, that's really it. I mean, you have to drive 25 miles to go to Walmart, you know?
But Brittany Boggs will not be joining the exodus of young adults from the region.
Because I love the mountains. It's home. They're beautiful. This is where I was born and raised.
And the people?
They're the sweetest, kindest people you'll ever meet. I really don't have any neighbors up here, but just for instance, at Mom and Dad's house, they go out of town. They don't have to worry about their health. When they come back, their neighbors can tell them everybody who knocked on the door, get their mail for them without being asked. If there's a death in the family, you know, people come help you clean your house. Food, you have enough food to live a month off of.
Some might say it's a tough life.
I think it takes special people. I think God put special people here in these mountains. And we are tough, but in a sweet way. We work together. Not just the family, but the community. Everybody pitches in, and we're taught at young ages to work. Hoeing, digging potatoes when we're 5 years old. There's just no place like home.
Brittany Boggs of Cumberland, Kentucky. You can find this and past episodes on our website at esweku.com. Click on the Humans of Central Appalachia tab. The artists of Lexington's Northside neighborhoods are about to receive long overdue and much-needed attention. Call up Saturday, April 27th on your calendar and tap in a reminder to be sure to stop by the Northside Festival, happening on the grounds of Loudoun House, the home of the Lexington Art League, whose Adrian Dixon is here to fill us in. Thanks for joining us, Adrian.
Thank you for having me.
So this festival not only celebrates Northside artists, but it's in honor of one in particular. Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's in honor of LaVon Williams, who is a prominent national wood carver. He learned these skills from his older brother that were passed down from his great uncle. He has been a resident of Lexington's Northside for many years. He lives right off of Jefferson Street. And we're really excited to be honoring him, his skill set, and also artist of the Northside.
So how did the idea for the Lexington Art League's new Northside Festival originate? Why the Northside?
The Lexington Art League has recently realigned their mission. We were mostly a contemporary art space, but now we're trying to still focus on some contemporary art, but mostly realign our mission to accommodate what artists in the Lexington community need. So we were thinking, what can we bring to the community? And we thought, wouldn't it be great to have a little mini woodland art fair on the north side, on the grounds of the Art League, and have our galleries open and just have this great day on the north side in this wonderful event and bring some artists and live entertainment and things like that.
Okay, so how are artists selected for this festival, and what kind of art will they be displaying? Will their work be for sale, for example?
With any of our artist opportunities, we typically do an open call where artists can apply with images and a little bit about their work. And then we do a jury process. And then we select a range of artworks. So there's going to be some wood carving, of course. Levon will have a tent. There's also going to be some painting. There'll be jewelry. There'll be some illustrative works. We have a wonderful artist who is doing some embroidery fiber pieces, like fun patches or fun embroidery on jackets and hats.
The Art League already runs the Woodland Art Fair every year. You do that in partnership with Lexington's Department of Parks and Recreation. So why did the Art League decide that a spring art fair at Loudoun House on the north side is needed?
You know, we just really thought that that community needs more events. We have Night Market on the north side, which is the first Friday of the month, running from May to December. And we love that and support that event with No Lie. So we're partnering with them, Parks and Recreation, and other local businesses and organizations. Black Lotus Yoga, that's sort of newer to town, is a sponsor as well. And we just thought, you know, we need more events celebrating this community. So really just wanting to bring a wonderful event to the community.
And there are going to be art exhibitions inside Loudoun House. It'll be open?
Yes, yes. Our galleries will be open, free to the public, which our galleries are very special. Personally, I can speak of the specialness of the Loudoun House, its history, beautiful, one of five Gothic castellated villas left in the United States. And we have five shows up right now. We have Levon Williams, who will be in the Northside Festival and is in honor of, Victor Palomino, who is also partaking in having a booth outside. We have a fiber show called Gathered. We have a show by Milieu, who's kind of illustrative painter, and then Woodworkings by Gary Graham, and his work is quite spectacular and detailed.
This is going to be really interesting.
Yeah.
So tell our listeners what else they can expect from the Lexington Art League in 2019.
Absolutely. Well, of course, we are bringing to the people of Lexington the Woodland Art Fair, which we're ramping up for as well. We also have about 26 exhibitions in total this year. In the past, we've done four or five large-scale exhibitions. But this year, we are trying to accommodate more artists, create opportunities, and make it so our guests always have something new and exciting to visit at the Loudoun House. And of course, we'll also put on Prohibition, like we traditionally do. And we will be doing the Nude in December, and biannually, we'll alternate that with the Member Show, is something new we are also planning. Prohibition, we do with this organization who calls themselves Prohibition. It's a lot of mural art, a lot of street art. We really keep it open. It's our most open and accepting show. So maybe you haven't showed before anywhere and you want to tap into the local art scene or just try out art in general. We accept a lot of sort of experimental artwork and try to keep that open.
And if you haven't been in Lexington in a while, these murals are really incredible.
Yeah.
And they're beginning to show up everywhere.
They bring in national artists for that in addition to local artists. It's really spectacular.
Adrian Dixon is Events and Membership Director at the Lexington Art League. Thanks so much, Adrian.
Thank you so much for having me.
And again, the Northside Festival takes place April 27th on the grounds of the Loudoun House on Castlewood Drive in Lexington. Award-winning writer and poet Pauletta Hansel recently made a stop in her hometown of Jackson, the place where she first realized that she was a writer and a poet. WEKU's Sherry Lawson reports.
I'm the father of John and Jesse.
Hi, Andy. Good to see you again.
Good to see you.
It's a rainy Wednesday evening in Breathitt County, Kentucky. Award-winning writer and poet Pauletta Hansel is greeting people who've come to the library at Lee's College campus of Hazard Community and Technical College to hear her read from her latest book of poetry, Coal Town Photograph.
An ode to library basements and to the girl who skittered down the steps those bottomless Sunday afternoons to lose herself in possibility. You made me.
Hansel was born in Richmond, but says her family moved to Jackson when she was in about sixth grade. Her parents lived here more than 20 years. In addition to this being the place where she was an adolescent, it's the place she always came back to.
So this was home for many, many years, the place I would come for holidays and birthdays and, you know, everything in between. So I think about Jackson as being my hometown. My dad was a teacher here at Leeds College, and my mother started the first and at the time the only daycare center in Breathitt County, Kentucky. So between the two of them, they have had a relationship with about every family in the county.
On this night, the audience, many of whom remember Hansel growing up, are touched and inspired by her reading. Brenda Brewer went to high school with Hansel.
We've been so proud of her through the years. This is the first time I've actually got to see her and listen to her read. I really enjoyed it.
What touched you the most? Was there a moment or a poem or something that you really resonated with?
The poem's about her parents. A lot of that stuff described... some of my family, actually. I could relate to what she said.
Dresses with rickrack on the collars and the hems that matched her own. My brother's Batman cape. A gown for a miniature Kentucky First Lady that sits somewhere in a museum. Candles, donuts, soup beans for my father. Jello salad with mayonnaise in the middle and a maraschino cherries. My aunt's wedding cake.
Breathitt County's property assessor, Irvin Allen, says when his sons were young, they attended Hansel's mom's daycare. He says hearing Hansel read makes him think about her parents.
My mind flooded back over the years, and I could see her and him both as she was reading. And I smelled and breathed everything that she was reading.
She built my father's first bookcase from polished boards and bricks and thin rods of metal that she threaded through the holes of the bricks and the holes in the boards she had drilled to line up exactly. Those rods held the contraption together, and even then I knew she was the one held us together like a strong spine.
Now the Appalachian writer is living in Cincinnati, where she was the city's first poet laureate. She's the author of 7 poetry collections. The most recent is Coal Town Photograph. Her 6th book of poetry, Palindrome, was awarded the prestigious Weatherford Award for the Best Appalachian Poetry Book of 2017. And she's managing editor of Pine Mountain Sand and Gravel, the literary publication of the Southern Appalachian Writers Cooperative. Tim Dunn is professor of English at Leeds College.
Her work has been as important as just about any other Appalachian poet, any poet of the region over the past decade.
Hansel has returned to Jackson to share her poetry and contribute to Project Heal Jackson. She says the project is a program started by writer and artist Theo Edmonds. It uses writing and other forms of art as a way of helping a community find hope within its issues. She's been spending time with students in the Breathitt County schools. Hansel says through writing activities, she's sharing with the students a message she received as a 6th grader when she attended Breathitt County Junior High.
You have something to say, and you are the only one who can say it in the way that you do, and so let's hear it.
She says being able to complete that circle is a real gift to her. For WEKU, I'm Sherry Lawson.
That wraps up this week's edition. Eastern Standard is a broadcast service of Eastern Kentucky University, produced in the Lexington studios of Dynamics Productions with the support of One, the Alltech Ideas Conference, a global nexus of innovation for the future of food and the farm. Our executive producer is Mike Savage. Neil Kesterson is our producing engineer and audio editor. Eastern Standard is on the WEKU mobile app and available as a podcast on NPR One, iTunes, Google Play, and Stitcher. Our email, es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.